Good morning. Welcome in Virtual Africa and Creative Disturbance. My name is Ivantina. I'm from Texas. I'm a student at the University of Texas at Dallas. And I'm talking today from Texas with Marcus Neustetter, who is in South Africa at the moment. Marcus, can you introduce yourself once again, please?
Hi. Yes, thank you for having me as part of this program. My name is Marcus Neustetter, Johannesburg-based artist, cultural activist, and I guess producer of projects, and working in the field of crossover art, science, and technology, and social engaged projects in public space.
Okay, thank you. We were talking about platform in Africa, and I wanted in this podcast to advance on this on your use of the scientific and technologic materials. And it seems that you have a more local approach toward, in your practice. Can you come back on that question, please?
Sure. I think one of the critical paths that one takes when one's in a context like, any third world or developing country context, I guess, is to, and working with technology and sciences, is to say what its local relevance is and how one can use it effectively to challenge the status quo of the world, you know, yes. that's kind of present us with these platforms. So my general approach is always to look at locally relevant technology, low technology rather than the high technology, technology that can be recognized, used, and engaged, etc., which means that the artworks or the outcomes of the projects are usually much more site and locally specific and locally demonstrative of connectivity and use thereof. So,
side projects, right?
Sorry?
I mean, you're developing specific side projects.
Exactly. So there's several examples, but as a solo artist over the years working in that kind of crossover of art, science, technology, I've used cheap lights from Chinatown, for example, to create big spectacle events, just because that's what's available for me to play with, you know, rather than trying to get the best projector. Mm-hmm. And conceptually, that becomes more meaningful because it is about that accessibility and what one can find and how one has to think innovatively within the situation that one has, rather than trying to put up big budgets and big production. And similarly, in collaboration with Stephen Hobbs in the Trinity session and a lot of the projects that we've done, we very often try to mimic or play with this idea of how we yearn towards or try to catch up with the technology of the first world, but actually subvert it in a fun and crazy way. So, I mean, there have been fun projects where we, for example, were invited by UNESCO to be part of an exhibition in Dakar to talk about media art, and all we decided to do, because there have been so many blackouts and power cuts in Dakar when we were there, is just to put a generator into the exhibition, and that was our work. And funnily enough, it ended up being used to power some of the other works. You know, so it's
I came across this video where you're talking about a Senegalese coming to South Africa, to Johannesburg, and who show you a map, a kind of, you know.
We were taking photographs in the neighborhood of Johannesburg that is quite dangerous, so to speak, or was, and Stephen and I walk around a lot in the city, exploring the city, because that's what we do, and we're taking pictures. And this Senegalese immigrant said to us in French, "This is a dangerous neighborhood, take care of your cameras." And French is not one of our official languages. And I'm born and bred in Johannesburg, and so is Stephen, and like literally live around the corner from where this guy spoke to us. And so we were treated as tourists in our own city. So when we were then invited to Dakar for the Dakar Biennale, for the OFF program, by an organization called Kiatiasson to do a project. And the French Institute was going to pay for it, and they said, "We'll fly you over and do something in Dakar." And Stephen and I both said, "Well, what is meaningful in Dakar to us? Why Dakar?" And so we actually went back into Hillbrow, remembering this moment where we were being treated as tourists in our own city, and we tried to find as many Senegalese people as we could, and we asked them to draw us maps of Dakar. And using only those maps, no other Google Earth, no other Lonely Planet, nothing, only the hand-drawn maps by these Senegalese immigrants, we landed in Dakar and for 10 days tried to navigate the city. And we got horribly lost. It was the first time there. We knew nothing. And these maps were totally abstract. And we got a few interesting connections. We met people. We started to ask questions. We traversed the city in a very different way. But the highlight of the project was not, you know, kind of simulating what GPRS should be doing for us, you know, in the form of a paper map. But it was coming back to Heilbron, back to this neighborhood where these immigrants were living, a lot of them in fear because of xenophobia in South Africa, a lot of them because they're illegally in this country. We showed them photographs of our journey based on their maps, you know, in this nightclub, in Congolese nightclub in the middle of Heilbron. And basically that moment defined for us a really interesting relationship with an immigrant community that doesn't trust anyone, you know, for obvious reasons. And they became literally collaborators with us for many more projects going forward, because it was that gesture from our side to get to know our own neighbors in our own city that was more important for us than trying to do a successful big style project in Dakar. So the mapping, the traversing, the getting to know your neighbors isn't just about sending pictures via some social media platform, but it is about physically enacting what those things could be. So we actually were mimicking a little bit this high-tech, low-tech approach.
So what is the value of this map to you? What is more interesting in the use of this map that you cannot find with Google Map or on any other OpenStreetMap made by a citizen?
It's the people that you interact with because you're lost. You know, it's the bodily traversing of space and interacting with the space. So while the Google Map gives you alternative information and augmented reality opportunities and all kinds of other things, at the end of the day, for you to sit down with a group of I'm using this example, I'm going to continue with the Senegalese example, to sit down with a group of Senegalese drinking tea on the side of a road in the middle of Dakar because you're actually lost and you don't know where you're going, and you're trying to explain to them that this piece of paper is your map and where do you go next and can they help you decipher what this map is, becomes the moment where cultural, call it, in my opinion, something like cultural empathy almost occurs, where you become a global citizen and where everyone will understand that we're all at some point tourists in our own cities and lost in our own context. And this device, like the piece of technology or the Google Map or whatever, is merely a tool to prevent that, because we in today's time spend so much time moving from point A to point B, we're not interested in how we really get there. We're more interested in getting there, while arriving there. While we in this project really realize what it means to get from point A to point B when you don't actually even know what point B is, and trusting that process. Trusting that step forward is a lot of what I find in a lot of African cities that I've visited, where the trust to take the next step towards challenging the next street corner, the infrastructure, the methodologies of approach, especially in a post-colonial context. It means we have to reinvent our cities. It means we have to reinvent the spaces that belong to someone else once. And how do we do that? We have to have enough trust to take ownership of that space and to move through that space and have dialogue. And you can't do that with a Google Map. You know, you could rename a street based on now it's a new culture and new people and say, well, Google Map is telling you now that you've got a new street name. But if you don't identify with that street name and if you don't identify with the story behind it or even understand it, then why do it in the first place? So there's a really interesting step that happens in challenging these global things that we think make our lives easier, but at the same time, they eliminate something else.
This is an aside question, but this reminds me a little bit, you know, the situationist approach of psychogeography and derivation. Have you been inspired by this kind of...
I'd like to ask who hasn't. No, I think the derive, you know, the kind of the... Of course, these are concepts that are familiar to us and our inspiration in one form or another. I think the question is where it comes from and why one does it. You know, just to be inspired by something and to reenact it doesn't work if something doesn't tell you that you should be doing it. So the fact that we live in a city like Johannesburg that is constantly changing and shifting, and so radically so that you have to constantly question your own presence in the city, especially given you know my background. I'm kind of born, bred Johannesburg, but I'm a white South African individual. I've got a question around when I walk down the city, is this a space I can occupy? How can I occupy it? How do I fit in? Am I always a tourist in this place? So if you're in a place like that, then suddenly you use these tools of you know, the situationist, for example, or the Derive, you know, the narratives of the Derive. You use them for a bit of fun and play, but they come from a real point of survivalist strategy. I mean, they come from a point that you want to have a conversation with someone, because if you don't, you're alienating yourself and you don't know anything about your own context. And it's very sad to say that in a lot of cities that I've been to within especially the sub-Saharan continent, we find the same situation where you've got big neighborhoods with high walls and non-negotiation, so to speak, of public space because of fear, because of whatever diplomats and expats and all the rest of it living in the space, because of injustices that were there. And the only way as an artist to try and break down those walls is to have these conversations and try to make sense of how you create new ownership in these types of cities. And that very often is the challenge for us as artists, especially in what Stephen and I do as the Trinity Session, is that in order to make work that is relevant in public space and relevant to the social context that we're in and relevant to an audience that doesn't really care about art, we really have to ask ourselves the question, where do we operate and why do we operate there and how do we make sense of it for ourselves and for them? Because, yeah, and the only way we can do that is by finding tools of communication.
Thank you. I know that you have been involved. I mean, you have been working in different countries in Southern Africa. But there's one in particular that I would like to talk about now because I'm from this country, it's Cameroon. Mm-hmm. How have you been across this public space project funded by the Tate in London and Dual Art?
So the curator that worked for the Tate for Tate Modern for a while as the African representative, Elvira Danganiose, she she has a project called Across the Borders where she's basically promoting projects within the African continent rather than just bringing them to Europe and presenting them there. And she'd been following our work for a while and thought that our projects might be relevant for the Sud Triennale, which was run by Dual Art. And so working together with Dual Art and Elvira, we went on a kind of a research trip and just to understand what was happening. And Dual Art has always been very high on our radar as respected peers in working in public space. I mean, for many years, we've been commissioning public art in the city of Johannesburg as kind of a business to try and develop opportunities for the arts. We were part of developing the public art policy here, etc. And always, as a reference, we use a lot of the things that Dual Art is doing in Cameroon because of the innovative way of not just making public art, but using art as a vehicle to transform and create neighborhoods through infrastructural development, not just artistic projects. And so we quoted them very often. So for us, it was a real honor to have the opportunity to work with them. So when we arrived there, we confronted with these incredible projects that they've done over many years with a lot of socially engaged process, where they've built bridges to connect neighborhoods, where they've built infrastructure around drinking fountains, where they've built a layered a sustainable planting project. You know, how do you as an artist quickly pop in there and do a project and suppose that you can do any justice to it by not really understanding that context? So our research was more about looking at the projects that they'd done and thinking about what is the acupuncture that happened through those projects? What changed in the place once those projects had happened? And there was particularly one area called Vale Bisenge, which for us was a really inspiring space where a bridge was built, a drinking fountain was developed, or kind of architectural structure around a drinking fountain, which became a social space and a store. and that whole public area that developed because of these connections and activities gave rise to a young coiffeur, a hairdresser, who started his hairdressing salon they call Thomas.
His Thomas Hair Salon, right?
Yep, exactly. And so Thomas Fashion, as he calls it, is an incredible space because he himself has got an interesting story about his history as a as someone that didn't have much and through an apprenticeship doing hair. He actually said he used to be a thief or a thug, and but changed his life through doing hair. And he is now training youngsters to become hairdressers. And his one statement to us was he'd like to break out and be able to do more for people, but he doesn't have the portfolio to necessarily show it. He doesn't have, you know, like how could he be more active in creating more unique things? And so our proposal then to Elvira and to Dwalart was let us help as artists, instead of trying to build a bridge or anything like that, let us use Thomas' need for showing off his skills. Let's make a portfolio with him. Let's develop something artistic and let him put together a series of hairstyles that will change the neighborhood by uplifting the people that are there. He needed to invite his models, so to speak, was the proviso, was that his models are people from the neighborhood that he wants to inspire or that have inspired him. So everything from an elder lady who has inspired him because she started her own business selling tomatoes and is now kind of a successful business entrepreneur who's teaching him business skills, to the person that taught him to read and write at a late stage, to a young boy who sells food before he goes to school so he's got money in the afternoon for his parents. You know, all of these very inspiring stories became his models, and each hairstyle represented a different story, and each design of, styling represented that. And all we did was we witnessed it. We photographed it, we documented, we followed them around with a camera. Obviously, the moment you put a camera into it, it all changes. But we basically facilitated about 10 days of fashion transformation of a lot of individuals that were not very proud of who they were or not feeling as positive about who they were, etc. And suddenly they had a very different image on themselves. But the intention wasn't that. The intention was to see how it could inspire a neighborhood and draw attention back to the bridge and the fountain and all of the things that were happening due to Dwalart. And so it ended with a big fashion show where he redid with all of his assistants, etc., redid all of the fashion and things from the last 10 days, and we created a big spectacle in Basenga, and everyone was there. It was crazy. And it became a big party and an event, but, you know, we used the bridge as part of the fashion ramp, and we used the fountain as a place to show things off, and it really became about a spectacle and an experience. And now he has photographs that are fun and cool and funky that he can show around and use that as his portfolio. But for us, most importantly, was the process that we all went through in understanding what it means to purely creatively produce with stories in the background. Now, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
No. Unfortunately, I
sorry.
I have to break down this discussion because it's very interesting. I had a last question, which was a little bit more provocative. I was wondering if, you know, regarding your more local approach, how do you think that the use of high technology as opposed to loud technology could be relevant to, you know, for local approach?
So locally, I think.
Do you think that people appropriate themselves high technology for this kind of social and local projects, or?
Very often we don't have enough high technology infrastructure to really support really innovation through high technology processes. But what is happening is that the cell phone, for example, is a perfect example, is becoming more and more, the smartphone is becoming more and more accessible all over the place. And as that is happening, so will the appropriation of high technology to become low technology. You know, that is the obvious evolution of technology. The problem is that the language systems, the knowledge sharing and all of that is still rooted within a educational and language system that is not locally relevant or locally specific, let's call it that way. So okay. What's happening is that we have to learn a global language in order to participate. And so I do think that there are some really exciting initiatives that are locally driven that are challenging that. And I think they are using high technology, but they are appropriating and twisting it in there. ahead. And I'm looking forward to seeing what happens next with that.
Thank you very much. Of course, indeed, I mean, the language issue of Africa is at the heart of Virtual Africa. So thank you very much, Marcus Nestetter. See
thank
you later.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.
Bye.